by the Russians, who would control the public response to these questions? Most important, should the president become involved? None of these things had been thought through because it was assumed that Soviet missiles could not hit the high-flying aircraft, and even if by some miracle they did, the pilot could never survive the destruction of his plane at 70,000 feet. All these assumptions proved false. The Soviets stayed quiet until May 5th when Khrushchev, taking the podium in a packed Kremlin hall before a meeting of the Supreme Soviet, made his stunning announcement. A U.S. aircraft had violated Soviet airspace and been shot down. The deputies received this news with thunderous applause and cries of, "Shame! Shame!" Khrushchev undertook a lengthy harangue against the Pentagon militarists who had sent the plane on the eve of the Great Summit. Someone inside the U.S. government, he asserted, wanted the summit to fail. Ambassador Tommy Thompson, who was present in the hall to hear Khrushchev's speech, cabled Washington that in his view, Khrushchev had deliberately left open a back door through which Eisenhower could, if he wished, conduct a dignified retreat. By pointing the finger at alleged and unnamed militarists or mere incompetence on America's part, Khrushchev signaled that he did not want to slam any doors, Thompson believed. If Eisenhower offered his regrets for the incident and found a suitable scapegoat to take the blame, Khrushchev might allow the summit to proceed unhindered. This is what he seemed to signal in saying, "I do not doubt President Eisenhower's desire for peace." Indeed, according to his son, Khrushchev truly believed the flight came from unauthorized military officers in the CIA, not from the president. He hoped Eisenhower would apologize and the summit could continue. But the Soviet leader had inadvertently forced Eisenhower into a corner. Either the president had to admit he had sent the spy plane 2 weeks before his long-planned summit, or he had to apologize for the overflight while acknowledging that he did not control his own government. As Eisenhower stalled, his staff badly bungled the job of working out a reply to Khrushchev's allegations. On May 5th, in an inexplicable moment of confusion, both the State Department and NASA issued separate documents. The State Department stuck with the original cover story, but NASA provided quite a bit of additional phony information: that the U-2 was one of 10 flying weather laboratories that NASA operated out of Europe, Turkey, Pakistan, Japan, and the Philippines, that it contained no reconnaissance cameras, that it was a civilian aircraft flown by a civilian scientist, that it was conducting routine weather research and had not intended to stray across the Soviet border, and more. All of this was information the Soviets could easily disprove. And so they did. Khrushchev, with his flair for propaganda, announced on May 7th in another dramatic speech to the Supreme Soviet that not only did the Soviets possess the plane, its cameras and film, but that the pilot, Gary Powers, was alive and kicking. Khrushchev took pleasure in rebutting the flimsy cover story, brandishing the photographs that the U-2 had taken. He also reported that the pilot had readily confessed that he was no civilian weather analyst. Powers admitted that he was a former Air Force pilot who worked for the CIA. The United States had been caught in a very public lie. 3. When you are in a hole, the saying goes, the first thing to do is stop digging. This simple adage might have helped Eisenhower's staff, but they failed to heed it. On May 7th, in reply to Khrushchev's astounding announcement that Powers had survived the crash and was in custody, the president approved yet another press release. This one was drafted by Herter, who had just arrived home from a trip to the Near East. The statement acknowledged that, in endeavoring to obtain information now concealed behind the Iron Curtain, a flight over Soviet territory was probably taken by an unarmed civilian U-2 plane. Straining credulity, the statement also said that there was no authorization for any such flight. Instead, the flight had been restricted to the frontiers of the USSR. Perhaps, Herter reasoned, this clumsy fudging might appease Khrushchev while protecting the president. The statement was a disaster. It admitted that the United States had been spying on the Soviets for years using a spy plane, yet it also claimed that no one in high authority had ordered the plane to fly into Soviet airspace. While confessing to an egregious act of espionage, the wording of the statement supported the cartoonish allegation that Eisenhower was a detached, golf-playing, absentee president. The national press was aghast. "This was a sad and depressed Capitol tonight," James Reston wrote from Washington. "It was depressed and humiliated by the United States having been caught spying over the Soviet Union and trying to cover up its activities in a series of misleading official announcements." Eisenhower's fond hopes for a great breakthrough in Paris were overshadowed by a swirl of charges of clumsy administration, bad judgment, and bad faith. Even now, with all the American fumbling, Khrushchev had not yet settled on how to react. At a reception on May 9th at the Czech embassy in Moscow for the diplomatic corps, Khrushchev pulled aside Ambassador Thompson and greeted him warmly. Khrushchev said he could not help but suspect that someone had launched this operation with the deliberate intent of spoiling the summit meeting. He seemed to think it was quite possible that Eisenhower really did not know about the U-2 flight and that Alan Dulles was responsible. Khrushchev had a great deal riding on the summit and did not want it to fail. He clung to the faint hope that a scapegoat could be found. Yet none appeared. Instead, Eisenhower decided, about a week too late, to assert some personal control over the mess his team had created. Instead of firing Dulles, putting the blame on an overzealous subordinate, announcing an inquiry and assuring the Soviets that he would not allow such overflights in the future, Eisenhower decided to take the path of personal honor. On May 9th, he ordered yet another press release, the fourth on the U-2 affair in just 5 days, and finally admitted that the United States had conducted extensive spying on the Soviets, including periodic overflights of their territory. The statement adopted a defiant tone, insisting that the U.S. government would be derelict if it did not try to ascertain Soviet intentions and capabilities, given the enormous power of new missile technology to destroy the world. If Khrushchev had left open an escape hatch for Eisenhower, the president soon nailed it shut. On May 11th, at his weekly press conference, Eisenhower came clean. In a prepared statement, he described spying as a distasteful but vital necessity. He coolly invoked the World War. "No one wants another Pearl Harbor. This means that we must have knowledge of military forces and preparations around the world, especially those capable of massive surprise attacks. Secrecy in the Soviet Union makes this essential. In most of the world, no large-scale attack could be prepared in secret. But in the Soviet Union, there is a fetish of secrecy and concealment. This is a major cause of international tension and uneasiness today." Far from apologizing, Eisenhower remained defiant. "If you would agree to open your country to weapons inspections and sign disarmament agreements, we would not have to spy on you." The May 11th press conference marked an important moment in Ike's presidency and in the history of the Cold War. Rather than leave things vague or heap blame on a subordinate or offer a muted apology and a reassurance that such things would not happen in the future, Eisenhower embraced spying as a professional obligation and threw a cloak of invulnerability around all his subordinates who had worked on the U-2 program. He would not offer a head on a platter. He would not apologize. On the contrary, he would blame the Soviets for their obsessive secrecy and militarism. Eisenhower's actions on this day won him everlasting praise from intelligence professionals, and many subsequent biographers who have seen in this moment the true character of a great leader. When things go wrong, the president must take the blame. And having cleared the air in this manner, Eisenhower saw no reason why the summit in Paris could not go ahead as planned. Some critics, though, wondered if Eisenhower had acted wisely. Alan Dulles and Richard Bissell had given the president faulty advice about the U-2 plane's vulnerability. They had pushed for a flight just 2 weeks before the summit, and then bungled the cover-up. Eisenhower could have found a diplomatic way to deflect responsibility onto these risk-taking subordinates, as Khrushchev wanted him to do. Eisenhower's decision to take the blame may have pleased his staff, but it destroyed the Paris summit. As Walter Lippmann wrote in his column, Eisenhower locked the door which Mr. Khrushchev had opened. In his press conference, Eisenhower transformed the embarrassment of being caught in a spying operation into a direct challenge to the sovereignty of the Soviet Union. Lippmann believed that Eisenhower's refusal to use the convention of diplomacy was a fatal mistake. For Khrushchev to accept without protest Eisenhower's statement and continue with the summit would be a terrible blow to Soviet prestige and sovereignty. Even a leader less sensitive to personal slights than Khrushchev would never have done that. Eisenhower chose an honorable path, one that kept his reputation for decency and integrity intact, yet the price of that noble act was a dramatic worsening of the Cold War. It is fair to ask if the price was too high. At almost the same time Eisenhower was speaking to the press, Khrushchev paid an emotional and stormy visit to the exhibition hall in Gorky Park in Moscow to inspect the wreckage of the U-2 plane that was put on public display. Before a gaggle of journalists, he gave vent to his fury and indignation. "Impudence! Sheer impudence!" he cried, inspecting the bent and scorched metal of the plane. "Only countries which are at war with each other can act this way." Asked about his opinion of Eisenhower, he sadly replied that he was horrified to learn the president did in fact authorize the overflight. "I had high hopes, and they were betrayed." Ambassador Thompson, hearing these remarks, cabled Washington in despair, "The Cold War is back on again." Certainly Eisenhower met with a chilly reception when he arrived in Paris on May 15th, gathering with the host of the summit, President Charles de Gaulle, and Prime Minister Harold Macmillan at 6 that evening, Eisenhower learned that Khrushchev had the day before presented to de Gaulle 3 demands that must be met for the conference to proceed. Eisenhower must apologize for the U-2 flight. He must ban all future overflights, and he must punish those responsible for the U-2 incident. Hearing this, Eisenhower reacted sharply. "The USSR had spies throughout the United States," he said, "and he would be damned if he was going to renounce or apologize for a practice everyone else carried on." Khrushchev knew perfectly well that Eisenhower would not agree to his demands. He had decided during his flight to Paris on May 14th to sabotage the summit. Later he explained his thinking. "We had to present an ultimatum to the United States. They would have to apologize for the insult and injury done to our country. We would have to demand that the president take back his statement asserting the right of the United States to make spy flights over foreign territory, something no sovereign state could permit." America's behavior had been an affront, Khrushchev felt, and if we simply sat down at the table as though nothing had happened and began negotiating in the usual way, such behavior would do great harm to our authority in the eyes of world public opinion, especially among our friends, the communist parties and countries that were fighting for independence. Khrushchev quite rightly thought the whole world was watching, and he could not buckle. When the summit opened on May 16th at 11 a.m. in the Élysée Palace, Khrushchev demanded the floor and attacked the U-2 overflight. Eisenhower and America's unwillingness to recognize the provocative and illegal character of such espionage. Unless Eisenhower condemned the overflight and promised future flights would cease, the Soviet government would leave the summit meeting. What's more, Eisenhower would not be welcome to visit the USSR under such circumstances. Eisenhower responded briefly and calmly. He had already put a stop to future overflights, and he reiterated that the U-2 flight had no aggressive intent. Its purpose was only to gather intelligence. Khrushchev refused to accept this gracious reply since he had already decided to scuttle the meeting. The combative premier insisted that Eisenhower apologize and that his apology be immediately given to the press. At this, Eisenhower went silent. The minutes indicate that he never said another word. His son John explains, Ike was struggling to keep his temper during Khrushchev's insulting monologue. Herder correctly concluded, it was clear that Khrushchev had been determined even before arriving to torpedo the meeting. 2 days later, the leaders departed Paris. A mere 48 hours after it began, the Big Four summit that might have altered the course of the Cold War had collapsed. It was easy enough to blame Khrushchev for the summit's failure, but Eisenhower too bore responsibility, which he refused to accept. Upon returning to Washington, he wrote letters to 24 friendly heads of state, casting Khrushchev as the villain for his calculated campaign to ensure the failure of the conference. The United States had done nothing that justified Khrushchev's polemics and abuse in Paris. In his memoirs, Eisenhower insisted that the only big error the United States had made had been to release an erroneous cover story. As for his role in approving the overflight at such a critical moment, he expressed no regret. I know of no decision that I would make differently, he wrote. Given his numerous, well-documented reservations about the overflights before May 1st, this statement is difficult to accept. Once again, Eisenhower protected his underlings, even at the expense of the truth. Though Eisenhower treated the U-2 affair with nonchalance in his memoirs, the downing of the spy plane had a huge impact on his presidency and on the Cold War itself. It shattered his hopes to bring about a thaw in the war, thereby robbing him of a brilliant achievement in his last months in office. It led to a sharp intensification of Cold War hostilities. It undermined all of his efforts to establish himself as a man of peace and goodwill in the eyes of the world's peoples, and it provided his domestic political rivals with powerful ammunition to use against him and his handling of the Cold War. In retrospect, his decision to approve the U-2 overflights in the spring of 1960 was the biggest mistake he ever made. 4. The collapse of the summit became a source of domestic political controversy. In the spring of 1960, both political parties had started weighing candidates to nominate for president in the November elections. The Republicans leaned heavily toward Vice President Nixon and a platform of peace and prosperity, the winning formula of 1956. But immediately after the Paris failure, the Democrats hit Ike hard. Adlai Stevenson declared the presidential campaign would now be waged under the darkest shadows that ever hovered over the world, the mushroom clouds of a nuclear war. Stevenson, speaking to an audience of 3,000 Democrats at a fundraiser in Chicago, summarized the affair in a memorable turn of phrase, Khrushchev wrecked the conference, but Eisenhower handed Khrushchev the crowbar and sledgehammer. It was America's series of blunders that gave the Soviet leader the pretext to walk out. Eisenhower and his administration have helped make successful negotiations with the Russians, negotiations that are vital to our survival, impossible. John Kennedy, the Democratic hopeful who had amassed 9 primary victories since March, was campaigning in the Oregon Democratic primary on May 19th when he too weighed in. He said in a brief campaign speech that if he had been president, he would have found a way to keep the summit going by expressing regret to Khrushchev. He initially used the word apologize, but then corrected himself. Senator Stuart Symington called for a new foreign policy built on the ruins of the summit conference. The Democratic Advisory Council, made up of leading liberals, declared that the fiasco in Paris had done incalculable harm to the cause of peace. The Democrats ripped the administration. The integrity of the word of the United States has been put into doubt. The danger of an all-out destructive nuclear war has been increased. The GOP revealed its fundamental lack of purpose in its foreign policy, they said. The Republicans did not take these attacks lightly. The Republican National Committee smelled appeasement in the air. Stevenson, it said, fell like a ton of bricks for the Khrushchev line. His wishy-washy, let's not anger the Russians position looked weak next to Ike's stalwart defense of America's Cold War strategy. On the floor of the Senate on May 24th, Hugh Scott, Republican of Pennsylvania, declared that Kennedy and Stevenson must now be asked to relieve themselves of the gross suspicion of appeasement for the suggestion that they might have apologized to Khrushchev. 6 hours later, Kennedy strode into the Senate chamber and fairly shouted, "I do not have to purge myself of the suspicion of being an appeaser," and demanded a retraction. Now the fat was in the fire. The Republican National Committee chairman, Senator Thurston Moorton of Kentucky, added more fuel, calling the Democrats soft on communism and asserting that Kennedy would have bowed to the Khrushchev bluster and expressed regret for the U-2 flight. Mike Mansfield, the assistant Democratic leader in the Senate, struck back. "We are not the ones who are soft on communism. We did not invite Khrushchev over here, and he has never invited a Democratic presidential candidate to visit him." The fight for the White House was on, and it would take place on a well-trodden patch of ground, determining which party was tougher on communism. In late May, Senator William Fulbright, the Democratic chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, opened an inquiry into the U-2 and Paris events. Leading figures of the administration were invited to testify, thus keeping the pressure on the Republicans to explain their mishandling of the affair. The investigation centered on the decision to order the U-2 into Soviet airspace, as well as the failure to handle the cover story adequately. The committee finally concluded that because of the enormous stakes of the Paris summit, the U-2 flight should not have been sent. In a speech to the Senate, Fulbright delivered a harsh verdict. "The prestige and influence of our country on the affairs of nations has reached a new low as a result of the administration's blunders. Sending the plane on May 1st was a serious error of judgment." More than that, Fulbright indicted Eisenhower personally on a key matter of presidential leadership. Echoing Lippmann, Fulbright insisted that Eisenhower made a mistake when he took the blame for the U-2 in a self-righteous manner that was unbearably provocative to the Soviet government and contributed substantially to the violence and intemperate bad manners of Mr. Khrushchev. Fulbright asserted, "It is unprecedented among civilized nations for a chief of state to assume personal responsibility for covert intelligence operations." Doing so all but forced Khrushchev to demand a personal apology that could not be delivered. There is some irony to savor here. While Democrats typically blasted Eisenhower as a detached, disengaged, golf-obsessed president, Fulbright blamed him for being too closely involved in the handling of the U-2 affair and for taking personal responsibility for the actions of his administration. Had he only floated above the dirty business of spycraft, feigned a lack of awareness of the CIA's program, and offered up Alan Dulles as a whipping boy, Fulbright's term, Eisenhower could have saved the summit. Never was there such an effective, if unintentional, rebuttal of the thesis that Eisenhower didn't run the store. Kennedy, by June the clear front-runner for the Democratic presidential nomination, knew that the events in Paris presented him with a golden political opportunity. Since he began his run for the nomination, Kennedy had been hitting the Eisenhower administration for its alleged weakness and confusion. He depicted American foreign policy as rudderless, failing, and reactive. The country was on a slide downhill into dust, dullness, languor, and decay, he claimed. Eisenhower offered only soft sentimentalism when America needed tough-minded plans and operations. Now, after the Paris fiasco, Kennedy pressed his case. In a speech in the Senate on June 14, 1960, before a packed gallery of admirers and autograph seekers, the handsome 43-year-old legislator delivered a scathing assessment of Eisenhower's Cold War strategy. It had all been based on an illusion, Kennedy argued. The illusion that platitudes and slogans are a substitute for strength and planning. The illusion that good intentions and pious principles are a substitute for strong creative leadership. The collapse of the summit revealed America's lack of coherent and purposeful national strategy backed by strength. Eisenhower offered only 11th-hour responses to Soviet-created crises. To counter Eisenhower's confusion and indecision, America needed a comprehensive set of carefully prepared, long-term policies. This portrait of a befuddled, ill-prepared Eisenhower out of his depth in a dangerous world became the leitmotif of Kennedy's campaign. Of course, the charges were hollow. Indeed, when Kennedy went on in his Senate speech to itemize all the things he proposed to do, he cribbed shamelessly from Eisenhower's own agenda. Kennedy demanded a stronger nuclear deterrent, beefed up conventional armed forces, a stronger NATO, more foreign aid, better relations with governments in Latin America, the Middle East, and Africa, a lasting solution in Berlin, and a serious effort at arms control, precisely the policies Eisenhower had pursued. RNC Chairman Morton responded by saying that Kennedy seemed to have endorsed the administration's policies, but said they should be carried out with brighter, nicer people. Yet the Paris fiasco, Khrushchev's sneering, Eisenhower's fumbling, the sense of dashed hopes, irked Americans all across the political spectrum. Just as Kennedy attacked Eisenhower from the left, another powerful assault hit Eisenhower from the right. It came from an Arizona Republican named Barry Goldwater. Like Kennedy, Goldwater was a handsome World War II veteran, and also like Kennedy, he came to the Senate in 1953. But unlike Kennedy, Goldwater did not want simply a better version of Ike's policies. He demanded a clean break from the Ike years. His indictment came in a short, powerful book titled The Conscience of a Conservative that hit the bookstores on April 15, 1960. In the 15 years since 1945, Goldwater argued, America had failed to maintain the dominant global position it had earned as a result of its great victory over Hitler. The country's leaders had stood by and watched as the Soviet Union gained power, territory, and followers around the world. American leaders had been complacent. Our leaders have not made victory the goal of American policy. Instead, they sought peace or settlements. We have tried to pacify the world, Goldwater stated. The communists mean to own it. For Goldwater, the sole objective of American foreign policy must be not to end the Cold War, but to win it. Goldwater scorned Ike's foreign policy with its reliance on defensive alliances, foreign aid, negotiations, disarmament, and the United Nations. He wanted the United States to defeat the Soviet Union and communism by taking the offensive, carrying the conflict into the enemy camp, subduing any and all challenges to American interests around the world, pressuring the USSR to withdraw and retreat. The risk of global nuclear war was real, he recognized, but such risks were better than accepting half measures and compromise. War may be the price of freedom. The militant tone of Goldwater's short book, in fact, ghostwritten by National Review writer Brent Bozell, echoed across the country. It became a bestseller within weeks. By November, it had sold 500,000 copies. On July 15, 1960, Kennedy accepted the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party. In his acceptance speech in Memorial Coliseum in Los Angeles, he laid out the essential themes of his campaign. The Republican leaders had let America decline, and it was time for a new and younger generation to revive the nation. The old era is ending. The old ways will not do. America had lost its stature on the world stage. The balance of power is shifting, he declared. Communist influence has penetrated further into Asia, stood astride the Middle East, and now festers some 90 miles off the coast of Florida. Friends have slipped into neutrality, and neutrals into hostility. The Republicans had allowed dry rot to set in. 7 lean years of drought and famine have withered the field of ideas. Kennedy, facing west and staring into the setting sun in the huge, and half-empty sports arena, challenged the voters to choose between national greatness and national decline, between the fresh air of progress and the stale, dank atmosphere of normalcy, between determined dedication and creeping mediocrity. Too many Americans have lost their way, their will, and their sense of historic purpose. The mere pursuit of creature comforts and an easy prosperity cannot animate a great nation. Leaders must articulate larger goals and ask the people to sacrifice in order to achieve them. He conjured up a vision of a new frontier, in which Americans once again took risks like the pioneers of old and set out to renew the promise of America. Whether the denunciations came from Democrats or Republicans, Eisenhower's reputation as a masterful statesman suffered in the spring of 1960. On the cusp of achieving what he hoped might be a real breakthrough in the Cold War, Eisenhower stumbled and missed his great chance, just when eager would-be presidents sought to take his place. Inevitably, his spirits sagged. His chief science advisor, George Kistiakowsky, recalled that sometime after the Paris summit, he found himself alone with the president in the White House. Eisenhower began to talk with much feeling about how he had concentrated his efforts the last few years on ending the Cold War, how he felt that he was making big progress, and how the stupid U-2 mess had ruined all his efforts. He ended very sadly that he saw nothing worthwhile left for him to do now, until the end of his presidency. A touching portrait, but perhaps misleading. For Eisenhower did not spend the last few months of his presidency as a weepy, self-pitying recluse. Rather, stung by the critics, angered by Khrushchev's rejection of his peace overtures, and driven to shore up his legacy as an effective leader, Eisenhower set out in his final months to reassert American power across the globe. Kennedy and the critics demanded more action, more aggression, more boldness, and Eisenhower meant to give it to them. Chapter 19. Fighting to the Finish. The past 8 years have been the brightest of our history. 1. Republicans of the 1950s knew how to sell a product. They pioneered the use of television advertising in politics, and at their national conventions in 1952 and 1956, they mobilized actors, dancers, acrobats, sports figures, crooners, jugglers, and sword swallowers to infuse their rather dull message of peace and prosperity with some pizzazz. In mid-July 1960, though, as the GOP faithful gathered in Chicago at the International Amphitheater, the same hall in which Ike and Dick had formed their political tandem 8 years earlier, the convention planners were running out of ideas. A giant elephant named Koa, on loan from Louisiana, proved to be too big to amble down the aisles of the hall and had to be returned. The torchlight parade of 500 young Republicans had to be canceled due to the fire hazard of their kerosene-soaked rags. Plans to get Henry Fonda into costume as Abraham Lincoln, a role he had played woodenly in the 1939 film Young Mr. Lincoln, were scotched when Fonda turned out to be a Democrat. Half the hotel rooms in Chicago remained empty a few days before the convention. Besides an absence of hoopla, the top Republican leaders had serious worries. A Gallup poll on the eve of the convention showed that since 1952, the Republicans had lost support among business and professional voters, white-collar workers and farmers, three key demographic groups. And they had made no inroads among skilled and unskilled laborers, who favored the Democratic Party by a ratio of 4-1. President Eisenhower's personal popularity had masked serious weaknesses in the Republican Party. As the Republicans gathered in Chicago, John Kennedy, a junior senator with little national name recognition, led Nixon in the polls by 4 points. The press corps, bored to tears by the lack of drama in Republican ranks, worked hard to breathe life into the candidacies of New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller and Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater, who might, they earnestly hoped, challenge Nixon for the GOP nomination from the left and the right. The Washington Post editorial page noted that both parties inclined toward moderate nominees like Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and Nixon, but cautioned that an excess of moderation can yield a pudding devoid of flavor or shape, and hoped that Goldwater would add a dash of pepper to the otherwise bland old party's Chicago solemnities. Indeed, old guard supporters of the dear departed Bob Taft now had a new champion in the ruggedly handsome conservative from the desert west. It was not to be. Goldwater did not seek the nomination and backed Nixon. Rockefeller, whom most veteran Republicans distrusted for his ideological elasticity and his vanity, pressured Nixon to adopt a number of Kennedy-like platform planks on issues such as defense spending, civil rights, health insurance, and housing. Nixon, terrified that a Rockefeller boomlet might snatch away his long-sought prize, caved in to these demands after meeting with Rocky in New York on July 22nd, 3 days before the convention opened. Rockefeller in turn threw his support to Nixon in a feeble gesture of party unity. In extracting concessions from Nixon on the GOP platform, though, Rockefeller managed to weaken Nixon's case that he and he alone had the toughness to confront Khrushchev on the world stage. The real challenge Nixon faced in taking the leadership of the Republican Party did not come from Goldwater or Rockefeller. It came from Eisenhower. Of course, Ike supported Nixon's presidential bid since Nixon offered the best hope of extending the Eisenhower legacy. But the distance between the two men, which had always been great, never seemed wider than in 1960. Eisenhower had become the world's most respected, most recognized, and most liked man. For all of his apparent political weaknesses and occasional lapses and his mishandling of the U-2 affair, he occupied an unassailable place in the pantheon of great figures of his time. His war service alone would have placed him on history's pedestal, but he followed that with 8 years of dignified leadership of a country whose global power had reached unprecedented dimensions. When Eisenhower arrived in Chicago on July 26th to address the Republican convention, over 1 million Chicagoans lined the streets along his route to the Sheraton Blackstone Hotel. Shouts of joy rang through the miles of well-wishers. "We like Ike," signs dotted the scene, along with hand-painted expressions of thanks to the old warrior. Confetti, so dense that it stuck to Ike's moist and beaming face, poured from the rooftops. Banners and flags draped every storefront and lamppost in a blaze of red, white, and blue. Seated behind him in the open-top presidential Lincoln, Illinois Governor William G. Stratton and Senator Everett Dirksen seemed like supernumeraries. It was Ike the crowd wanted. A loudspeaker in a truck following the motorcade blared out a popular tune by the Four Knights, "I Love the Sunshine of Your Smile." The president, visibly moved, told reporters outside the hotel, "It is one of the finest crowds I've ever seen." On Tuesday evening, Senator Dirksen, a famously orotund speaker in a profession known for producing magnificent windbags, came to the podium in the amphitheater to introduce the president. Few recalled that 8 years earlier, Dirksen had nominated Senator Taft and worked against Ike. Now Dirksen likened Eisenhower to Abraham Lincoln, the Illinois Republican whose gaunt visage hung on a huge poster above the convention speakers. During his presidency, Lincoln was excoriated and pilloried, criticized and maligned, caricatured and cursed. But with humility, determination, and firm resolve, he held the course and the Union was saved. Eisenhower, too, Dirksen asserted, has been assailed and impugned. He, too, has been mocked and castigated. But Eisenhower's simple political credo of peace through strength, devotion to individual freedom, limited and prudent government, and a spirit of compassion had healed the nation and brought it unprecedented prosperity. At 9:30 p.m., as Ike and Mamie stepped onto the stage, the crowd in the hall burst into riotous applause that endured for a full 8 minutes. Eisenhower then gave a powerful speech that showed how much fight remained in the old warrior. Nearing 70, a survivor of a serious heart attack, a major intestinal operation, and a small stroke, Eisenhower delivered a blistering defense of his 8-year record. The crowd, delighted by this demonstration of vigor, interrupted the speech 77 times with applause, shouts, and demonstrations of affection. In triumphant tones, Eisenhower struck sharply at those, especially Kennedy, who dared to doubt the power of the United States. "I glory in the moral, economic, and military strength of this nation," he said with an imperial flourish. "I bring no words of despair or doubt about my country, no doleful prediction of impending disaster. The United States is enjoying an unprecedented prosperity." He gleefully rattled off the economic results of his years in office. Compared to the Truman years, America enjoyed lower unemployment, higher wages, less inflation, a staggering rate of growth of the nation's productive capacity, higher rates of home ownership, greater investment in research and engineering education, and an expansion of Social Security. "And I had done it while balancing the federal budget." To those who had criticized him for letting America fall behind in the arms race, Eisenhower delivered an especially defiant blast. "In the sum of our capabilities, we have become the strongest military power on earth. But just as the biblical Job had his boils, so we have a cult of professional pessimists who continually mouth the allegation that America has become a second-rate military power." This claim infuriated him, and he savored the opportunity to deflate it. He enumerated the new aircraft, the vast web of radar alert systems, the arsenal of ballistic missiles, the nuclear-powered naval vessels, the technologically stunning Polaris submarine, the globe-circling space satellites, the newly equipped army, a breathtaking catalog of accomplishment on his watch. Giving due credit to the scientists, engineers, and armed forces who had built these weapons, he spoke with steel and fire in his voice. "To belittle this might, prestige, pride, and capabilities of these groups does such violence to my sense of what is right that I have difficulty in restraining my feelings of indignation." Bedlam in the hall. James Reston, who had covered Eisenhower closely during his 8 years in office, wrote that the president has never been more appealing or more effective politically than he has been this week in Chicago. The old magic was working again. Did anyone notice that during his long convention speech, Eisenhower never mentioned the name of Richard Nixon? No doubt Nixon noticed. He also observed the hero worship Ike received and must have gloomily wondered how he could compete with the president for the adulation of the country. Nixon and his running mate, Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr., faced the awkward challenge of running both on and against the Eisenhower record. Nixon wanted to benefit from Ike's successes while implying that he could fix the problems Ike had left unresolved. Playing against his natural instinct for political knife-fighting, Nixon posed as a moderate, tempered, and decent fellow, full of bromides and Boy Scout nostrums, in short, another Eisenhower. But the 47-year-old Californian possessed none of Eisenhower's authenticity. Eisenhower had a gift for making the corn-pone vocabulary of American politics sound decent and truthful. When Nixon tried it, he sounded artless and insincere. Nixon arrived at the amphitheater on July 27th, accompanied by his wife, Pat, and their daughters, Julie and Tricia. He received a warm welcome, though nothing like the delirium Ike prompted. His acceptance speech was wordy and lawyerly and lacked spark. Nixon told his fellow Republicans that 1960 was a time of greatness, but his bland comportment left them wondering if he was really the man for the job. Many in the hall looked wistfully at the brawny and uncompromising Goldwater. Nixon ticked off the usual list of domestic projects that needed attention. Health care, education, wages, more defense spending, more prosperity, more spirituality, and less government. Unlike the partisan, energetic, and heartfelt address by Eisenhower, Nixon's speech seemed engineered to tranquilize the convention and to reassure the television viewers that Nixon was a younger, technocratic version of the beloved incumbent. The crowds cheered dutifully and the band played California, Here I Come over and over again. But something about Nixon's uneasy, labored performance hinted at a difficult road ahead. And Eisenhower did not exactly smooth the path. In his first post-convention press conference, he seemed to suggest that the business of getting Nixon elected would not occupy much of his time. Yes, he said in reply to a question, he would promote the Nixon Lodge ticket, but this doesn't mean I possibly should be out on the hustings and making partisan speeches. After all, I've got a lot of other responsibilities, and I've got a lot of other commitments around the country. But I think these two fellows can take care of themselves pretty well. They are tops. A week later, prodded by the press, Ike called the GOP ticket fine, but considered himself just a spectator, since he was no longer running. It got worse. In a press conference on August 24th, Eisenhower again distanced himself from the political campaign, and perhaps from Nixon himself. Asked what big decisions Nixon had shaped while vice president, Eisenhower snappishly replied, I don't see why people can't understand this. No one can make a decision except me if it is in the national executive area. He went out of his way to stress no one three times when explaining who helped make his decisions. A few minutes later, when a reporter returned to the issue, Ike again insisted that he and he alone made the decisions in his administration. Of course, Nixon took part in the discussions, but not in the decisions. Eisenhower was on a slippery slope, and the veteran press corps sensed an imminent stumble, so they pushed him. I just wondered, said Charles Moore of Time magazine, if you could give us an example of a major idea of his, Nixon's, that you had adopted in that role. It was the last question of the press conference, and Ike was already preparing to depart the podium. Hastily, too hastily, he replied with a wry grin, If you give me a week, I might think of one. I don't know. Pow! Had Nixon been there, he would have dropped to his knees as if poleaxed. Although Eisenhower knew he'd blundered and called Nixon right away to try to reassure the candidate, the remark completely undid all of Nixon's own claims about his vast experience in government on which he had premised his entire campaign. With this unguarded remark, Eisenhower confirmed the widespread suspicion that Nixon did not enjoy the confidence or trust of the president. In retrospect, it seems plain that Eisenhower simply was not yet ready to share the stage with anyone, least of all, Dick Nixon. 2. Though staying aloof from the campaign, Eisenhower nonetheless felt the sting of Kennedy's attacks on his record. Kennedy blamed Ike for America's slippage in the Cold War. He questioned Ike's stewardship of the national defense and accused him of losing Cuba to the communists. He also asserted that the newly independent nations in Asia and Africa now looked to Moscow for inspiration rather than Washington. The Soviets were advancing, Kennedy charged, while America stood still. If Eisenhower wanted to rebut such democratic accusations of drift, the crisis in Central Africa gave him an opportunity to do so. On June 30, 1960, the former Belgian colony of Congo declared its independence. Its new prime minister was Patrice Lumumba, a charismatic leftist whose political party had won the most seats in the newly formed parliament. Wealthy in cobalt, bauxite, iron, manganese, zinc, and gold, Congo had been ruthlessly exploited by European mining interests for decades, while the Belgians shamefully deprived the Congolese of any social or institutional advancement. In 1960, the country was not well prepared for the trials of self-government. With independence, the nation's security forces fell to pieces as Congolese soldiers mutinied against their white Belgian officers and threatened the safety of some 100,000 Europeans still living in the country. In the midst of this chaos, the mineral-rich province of Katanga in southeastern Congo, where many of the leading industrial firms had headquarters, declared its own independence and also called for Belgian military protection. The Belgians promptly sent paratroops to the breakaway province, thus aiding and abetting the breakup of Congo while seizing the richest part of the country. Prime Minister Lumumba, angered by the Belgian military intervention, appealed to the United Nations to send peacekeeping soldiers to replace the Belgian troops. Locked in a global propaganda battle with the Soviets to win the allegiance of newly independent Third World nations, the United States had to support a peaceful resolution of the Congo crisis and duly helped pass a UN resolution to send in peacekeepers to restore order and to keep the country from splitting apart. By the end of July, some 11,000 UN troops had arrived in Congo to replace the Belgians. But the UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld insisted that these UN soldiers could not be used by Lumumba to compel the Katanga province to remain in Congo. Lumumba began to suspect that the UN forces had a secret agenda to provide cover to the secessionist province. In a very unwise move, Lumumba publicly denounced Hammarskjöld and demanded the UN withdraw from Congo. In mid-August, he turned to the Soviet Union with a request for military assistance with which to invade the rebellious province of Katanga and seize its secessionist government. Alan Dulles offered a simple explanation for the seesaw events in Congo. "In Lumumba, we were faced with a person who was a Castro or even worse," he told the National Security Council on July 21st. Lumumba, Dulles claimed, was in the pay of the Soviets. To Dulles, one Third World nationalist was like another. Lumumba was like Castro, Castro was like Nasser, Nasser was like Sukarno. They were all Soviet-inspired threats to American interests and had to be stopped. On August 18th, an alarming cable from Larry Devlin, the CIA station chief in Congo, landed at CIA headquarters. It seemed to confirm the worst predictions. With telegraphic brevity, Devlin wrote, "Congo experiencing classic communist effort take over government." Whether or not Lumumba actually commie or just playing commie game to assist his solidifying power, anti-West forces increasing power of Congo, and there may be little time left in which to take action to avoid another Cuba. Ike's advisors gathered at 9 that morning to discuss the problem. Under Secretary of State Douglas Dillon said that if the UN was forced to withdraw from Congo, the USSR would intervene at Lumumba's invitation, and the United States would be faced with a disaster. Dulles again insisted that Lumumba was in Soviet pay. Eisenhower said, "The possibility that the UN would be forced out was simply inconceivable." Ike spoke with real heat. "We were talking of one man forcing us out of the Congo, of Lumumba supported by the Soviets." According to the note-taker at this meeting, Robert H. Johnson, Eisenhower said even more than this. In testimony given in 1975 to a Senate investigation under the chairmanship of Frank Church, Johnson reported that Eisenhower said something, I can no longer remember his words, that came across to me as an order for the assassination of Lumumba. Johnson then went on to say that he could not be certain of Eisenhower's words or his intentions. "I have come to wonder whether what I really heard was only an order for some such political action." But his testimony implicated Eisenhower in the murder of a foreign leader. Other officials who were present at the meeting recalled it differently. Douglas Dillon and Gordon Gray gave testimony to Senator Church's committee denying that Eisenhower gave any such order, though they admitted that Dulles might have interpreted a strong statement by the president against Lumumba as an order for his assassination. General Goodpaster, in an interview given in 1975, firmly denied that Eisenhower ever discussed the assassination of Lumumba or anyone else. Precisely what Ike said at the August 18th meeting cannot be known with certainty. Yet his subordinates, all very careful and loyal men, acted as if the president had approved their course of action. Just a week after the August 18th meeting, Gray chaired a meeting of the 5412 committee, during which he reported on Eisenhower's state of mind regarding Lumumba. His associate, Gray said, using the code word for the president, had expressed extremely strong feelings on the necessity for very straightforward action in this situation. Dulles affirmed that he had every intention of proceeding as vigorously as the situation permits or requires. Both men insisted that planning for the Congo would not necessarily rule out consideration of any particular kind of activity which might contribute to getting rid of Lumumba. Cloaked in a fog of euphemism, these senior U.S. government officials were planning to oust and possibly murder Patrice Lumumba. This conclusion is supported by Dulles' own telegram to Devlin on August 26th. We conclude that Lumumba's removal must be an urgent and prime objective, and that under existing conditions this should be a high priority of our covert action. In his memoirs, Richard Bissell, Dulles' deputy and the man tasked with overseeing these various plots, explained how such matters worked in the halls of government. In official settings, the president did not speak of assassination. Instead, his colleagues interpreted certain phrases as approval for their extreme plans. If you had asked Eisenhower what he was thinking at that moment, he probably would have said, "I sure as hell would rather get rid of Lumumba without killing him, but if that's the only way, then it's got to be that way." Bissell clearly admired Eisenhower for his cold-bloodedness. Eisenhower was a tough man behind that smile. Bissell wished to implicate Eisenhower in the Lumumba plot to show that what followed had presidential approval. In late August, aware of the high priority Eisenhower gave to the Congo operation and the elimination of Lumumba, Bissell turned to his special assistant for scientific matters, Joseph Scheider, also known as Sidney Gottlieb. A graduate of Caltech with an advanced degree in chemistry, Scheider joined the CIA's technical services staff in 1951 and had been the leading person behind the CIA's experimental use of psychotropic drugs in human subjects. Bissell ordered Scheider to deliver toxic biological materials to CIA Station Chief Devlin in Congo's capital, Leopoldville. In late September, Scheider traveled to Congo with the vials of toxins in his luggage, carefully disguised as innocuous drugs, along with rubber gloves, a syringe, and a gauze mask. These he handed over to Devlin. Scheider told Devlin that the operation had been approved by the president. Just how the poison might be delivered to Lumumba, by food or drink or toothpaste tube, would be up to Devlin and his agents. Devlin had the good sense to see the murder by poison plot as zany and dangerous. Had the CIA carried it out and been discovered, it might have triggered an outburst of anti-Western sentiment across Africa at a terribly delicate moment. Devlin, therefore, locked the vials in his office safe and stalled. However, events moved so rapidly that Devlin did not need to carry out the poison operation. On September 14th, a coup d'etat led by Colonel Joseph Mobutu toppled Lumumba from power. The deposed prime minister holed up in his residence under the protection of UN troops, with Mobutu's police also standing watch. Even under house arrest, though, Lumumba still remained a powerful symbol. Eisenhower quipped that he wished Lumumba would fall into a river full of crocodiles. 2 days later, Dulles expressed esteem for Mobutu, the only man in the Congo able to act with firmness, and said that Lumumba remained a grave danger as long as he was not disposed of. Indeed, Dulles now termed Lumumba insane, making his elimination appear urgent. In late November, Lumumba fled his home to join his sympathizers in Stanleyville. But he was captured, imprisoned by Mobutu, and slated for trial. However, Mobutu had no desire to offer Lumumba a public platform. Instead, Mobutu handed Lumumba over to his political enemies in Katanga province, where Belgian and Katangan soldiers beat and tortured him. On January 17, 1961, they shot him to death and boiled his body in a vat of sulfuric acid. In the end, then, Lumumba did not die at the hands of the CIA or its agents. Yet the dismal tale of his fate in no way absolves the CIA or the U.S. government of responsibility. Colonel Mobutu's coup against Lumumba was undertaken with direct CIA knowledge and support, Lumumba's arrest by Mobutu's police served American interests, since both Mobutu and the CIA shared a desire to eliminate the former leader. And the CIA station chief knew that Lumumba was to be delivered to his political foes in Katanga, where he was certain